The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. Well, today is the first full day of activities at PYC over in Edmond. All the campers hopefully should have arrived yesterday and they'll be getting to know each other, getting in their dorms, doing some of their first activities today. And I'm sure Mr. Stephen Flurry is very busy with all of that as camp director, so I will be covering this morning. I thought I'd start with a few headlines. One, I thought this was a good one for the first day of camp up on the Drudge Report. If you want to make money, I have a good option for you here. This is from CBS Montana, and they write, a new type of parenting coach is gaining popularity. As reported in the New York Times, they're being paid to help raise your children to be phone-free. Phone-free. One woman runs a network of 500 coaches that includes a training system. They charge $80 in smaller cities and up to $250 in larger cities. Screen consultants come into home or schools to remind parents how people parented before. And I guess that means before screens. So while they'll be getting that experience at camp, like Mr. Flurry mentioned earlier in the week, a phone free experience, but I don't know, I thought it was amusing that people want to pay for that. I'll just cover a few other headlines that you may have missed shortly before we get into some of our main subjects of the day. One alert that pinged up on my phone as I was getting ready for today's show is that everybody's least favorite UK ambassador to the US has resigned, Sir Kim Darroch. He has stepped down. This came up a fair bit yesterday. Last night they had the main debates and between candidates to be Britain's next prime minister, and this came up a fair bit in those debates. Mr. Hunt, who is one of those that's in the running, was pretty anti-Trump and pro or anti-President Trump, and said he would not fire Sir Kim, whereas Boris Johnson, the candidate that seems overwhelmingly more popular, he refused to answer the question, but anyway, seemed a lot less anti-Donald Trump, which is interesting given the connection between those two. Another headline that caught my eye, this was a story in German Foreign Policy, and they had an article about German weapons showing up in Libya and Yemen. Now, German law bans selling weapons to conflict zones. There's a UN arms embargo about banning weapons sales to Yemen. But it seems that German weapons are getting to these areas via the United Arab Emirates. They have a very close partnership with the United Arab Emirates. Rheinmetall, for example, runs a training center there. And despite these weapon sales, Germany's been moving closer and closer to the United Arab Emirates. So they're obviously not too unhappy about what the UAE is doing with all of these weapons. But it's an interesting trend to keep watching. This is one of the one trend, Germany getting more involved in the Middle East, Germany creating an alliance through its arms sales is a key trend that we've been watching, and we can see the German weapons, especially there in Yemen, being used against Iran and against the Iranian Houthi-backed rebels. Another story I thought I'd bring to your attention, Spiegel had an article I think towards the end of last week, was talking about some of the new tensions in Germany with refugees. And I think there's a very interesting potential in Germany now for there to be increased tensions when it comes to refugees. Now, one of the aspects of the story is, you had a huge number of refugees coming, but that was back in 2015. That was several years ago. Since then, you haven't had any more refugee, or not in the same huge numbers, these refugees coming. There still have been plenty more coming, but not on the same scale. But what has started to happen now is, okay, it's 4 years down the line, and a lot of Germans are saying, even the ones that weren't against bringing these refugees in, they're starting to say, well, you know, you came in 3-4 years ago because of what was going on in Syria, but now the Islamic State has been defeated. We see that all over the news. You must be getting about ready to go home now. Well, we're glad we helped you out for a bit, but you know, surely it's time for you to go back to Syria. Now, as you can imagine, many of these people that came in from Syria are not at all keen at the idea of leaving safe, wealthy Germany and going back to still not too safe and not especially wealthy Syria. So as this tension bubbles up, you could see some renewed tension between Germany, or between Germans and Syrians and migrants. And again, this tension has been a major push towards people. The tension and the way that the mainstream government has dealt with this has been a major push, pushing people towards fringe politics, leading to this radical transformation in German politics, where the mainstream parties are in historic decline, and you've got some extreme and even neo-Nazi parties rising to the surface. So that trend could continue. And then Spiegel had another article where they pointed out that China has become the world's largest moneylender. They wrote, Beijing's foreign loans dominate the global markets almost to the same degree as its toys, smartphones, and electric scooters do. From Kenya to Montenegro, from Ecuador to Djibouti, roads, dams, and power plants are being built with billions in loans from Beijing. And all these countries will have to pay back those loans in the years to come with interest. So China's loaning out all of this money in pretty huge amounts. And you've already seen in some places, Singapore is the classic example of this, where they loaned this money out. Singapore had trouble bringing it back, and so then China said, well, we'll take ownership of that port then, instead of getting that money back. And now they've become this biggest money lender all around the world. It's causing a whole lot of countries to look to China in a special way, and you're starting to see the rise of China's global influence. That's something we've written about in some of our recent Trumpet magazines, an important trend to keep your eye on. So those are some of the top stories that seem to have caught my eye over the last few days that weren't already mentioned, that Mr. Flurry's covered over the last couple of days, some critical stories as well. But I want to focus, for the most part, on this first half, on an important story that you probably haven't heard much about. There's been a lot in the news about President Trump and him going to economic war, mostly with China. But there's another critical economic battle that is going on right now that's often overlooked. Switzerland is under siege. Now, I'd say it's the very early stages. It's a pretty lax siege. It's a bit of an exaggeration, I guess, to call it siege at this point. But Switzerland is coming under a lot of pressure from Europe, and the EU is gradually ramping up the pressure bit by bit. Now, this pressure from Europe that Switzerland is coming over is something the Trumpet pretty directly forecast about 20 years ago. We'll read some quotes from that article in just a little bit. But this is a story with implications far beyond Switzerland or even Europe. And that's why I want to spend some time on this today. It's not just about Switzerland, and it's not just about, say, Switzerland's stock market and some of these things that are going on over there. It's something that exposes Europe's dictatorial nature. And it's a nature that's coming to the fore more and more. It's something that is becoming clearer and clearer with each passing year, with each passing month. You know, Europe's taking actions against Switzerland that they shied away from 10, 20 years ago. But now you're just seeing that desire to control coming out and coming to the fore in Europe. And that's something that has got to be really concerning for everyone. It's no more let and let live. It's we want to control, we want to dominate. And we've seen that in other areas as well, but this is just one example of that. So with that in mind, let's look at what's going on in Switzerland. Ambrose Evans Pritchard over at The Telegraph, he had a really interesting article about a week ago And that was titled, EU Sharpens Torture Tools as Swiss Showdown Escalates into Energy War. So what's going on? Well, Switzerland, they've often been kind of this exception when it comes to the European Union. They're not an EU member, but if you look at a map of Europe, they're completely surrounded by EU members. They're kind of this little island of non-EU membership. So they've got to have some kind of relationship with the EU because everyone all around them is, you know, if they're going to have links with these other countries when it comes to, say, power lines, transport, crossing borders, financial systems, trade, it's going to be pretty inconvenient with them. It's completely surrounded by the EU not to have some kind of relationship. But at the same time, being neutral is kind of Switzerland's thing. And so they don't want to fully join the EU. A lot of people in Switzerland are pretty fiercely and proudly independent. Even the various different Swiss cantons, the states that make up Switzerland, they are proud and protective of their rights, and they don't want to give those up to the European Union. So what you've had is where the Swiss have signed about 120 different agreements with the EU to make it easier for them to trade, to travel, to do business with Europe. And if you've traveled around Europe at all, if you've just arrived in the UK, you see the arrival lanes where it says, you know, arriving from UK, EU, or Switzerland, because they have these same kind of travel arrangements and those kind of arrangements, even though they're not an EU member. But now, starting about 18 months ago, that's not good enough for Europe. Over the last year and a half or so, Europe has been saying, you know, you need to submit to certain EU laws now. It's not okay just to have these deals that we've done in the past. We want to have much more say now in how you run your country. And it's not just a case of Switzerland, say, looking at the laws and saying, okay, yes, we'll agree to this one. Yes, we'll agree to this one. Yes, we'll agree to this one. In certain areas, the EU is saying, no, we want you to promise to submit to all future EU legislation. So that's a pretty big handover of power to the European Union. The EU also wants Switzerland to, in a whole lot of areas, submit to the European Court of Justice. And this is a court that's interpretation of the law is kind of so weak and liberal that it makes Ruth Bader Ginsburg look kind of like a constitutional originalist. Their whole basis for their interpretation of their ruling basically is that the law means whatever the EU wants it to mean at this particular moment in time. And if it suits us, we will rule that it means something different. You know, this is the court that, despite the fact that it says in the EU law, no bailouts are allowed, you know, it's pretty much in black and white, they found a way to say that actually bailouts are allowed. So they don't uphold the rule of law by any stretch of the term. And so the Swiss are very reluctant to come under the jurisdiction of this European Court of Justice. But the EU is saying, no, you have to. You must submit. And this is something, you know, they've wanted to do this for a long time. About 10 years ago, Jean-Claude Juncker, who's now the European Commission president, he was at a different job there. I think he was the chairman of the Eurogroup back then. He said, it remains a geostrategic absurdity that we have this white spot on the European map. Again, referring to this little area of Switzerland that's not part of the EU. They've long resented that. But only now have they started to act on this desire to dominate and control Switzerland, to bring them under this EU law. Now, I think there's just a changing or a growing spirit of this in Europe. It's been there all along, but it's growing and it's strengthening. There's that. And then Brexit is another big factor of why they're doing this now. You know, they want to set an example to Britain. They're using Switzerland as a message. You know, they say they want to end this idea where you can be half in and half out of the European Union. They want to tell Britain, you know, you can't pick and choose areas that you like. You've got to either submit or you can't have the benefits of, or you can't just have free and open trade with us. So they're using Switzerland to try and send a message that way. But the Swiss here have said no. And the situation is a bit like Britain and America, even to a certain extent, when the elites are fine with submitting to the EU. The kind of those higher up in Switzerland, they don't really have a problem with this. But Switzerland has very strict laws about holding referenda on all of these kind of power transfers. And so if the elites sign up to this, it will have to be put to a referendum, and they know that that won't pass in a referendum. They know that they'll never get any kind of capitulation past the people. A recent poll showed that 20% of Swiss backed the EU's quote-unquote deal, which is basically, you know, we pass laws, you submit to them, while 67% said that they were against it. So an overwhelming rejection there. So Switzerland has refused to yield, and Europe is ramping up the pressure. They're gradually besieging Switzerland until the Swiss agreed. Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, in that article I mentioned earlier, he wrote that the clash with Brussels will become increasingly painful as the pressure ratchets up. The EU is determined to shut down the idiosyncratic Swiss model. It aims to bring the country within its legal and regulatory control once and for all under a new framework agreement. This means suspending 120 bilateral accords one by one as they fall due, progressively shutting the Swiss out of the EU's economic, transport and political system until they capitulate. It amounts to a sanctions regime. And stage one of this ratcheting up hit at the start of this month. The EU blocked European countries from trading in Swiss stock. Oh, sorry, trading on the Swiss stock exchange. So you've got now this remarkable situation where trading shares in Nestle within the EU could now land you in jail. And then, you know, Switzerland fought back. They banned the trading of Swiss shares in EU markets. It gets a little complicated, but it's basically tit for tat, trying to punish each other. And there was a lot of talk about the sky falling in Switzerland because of this. It hasn't happened. There's barely been any effect on the Swiss stock market so far, though some are saying that it'll be very bad for Switzerland in the long run. So, you know, the EU tried that punishment for not submitting. It hasn't worked. Switzerland is still holding out. They're still refusing to submit. So the EU is ramping up the pressure in other areas. So one of the areas they're moving in is energy. Professor Paul von Baal, from a French university, he said energy access for Switzerland is slowly deteriorating. So they're making it harder for Swiss firms to sell electricity to the rest of the EU. They're kind of shutting Switzerland or tilting the bureaucracy against it when it comes to selling energy onto other countries. Then they're moving on to other areas. They're talking about, for example, withdrawing mutual recognition for medical equipment, so Switzerland can't sell its medical equipment on to the European Union. These are relatively small areas, but it's a case of just ratcheting up the pressure. And what they keep wanting to do is keep adding on these small areas. If Switzerland doesn't capitulate, well, they'll add on something else. They'll add on something else until they've gotten rid of all of these 120 different accords, or until Switzerland submitted. Peter Klepp from Open Europe think tank, he said, in theory, the EU could cut off access to almost anything. It's a worrying precedent that a country can be cut off like this for purely political motives when it has not violated its obligations. Ambrose Evans-Pritchard concluded his article by saying the David and Goliath struggle can only end one way. The Swiss will eventually have to sign on the dotted line or face asphyxiation, or face being strangled. But the EU risks paying a high diplomatic and moral cost before that point is reached. It will be accused of bullying a small country and displaying a chronic inability to coexist with any of its near abroad. I mean, that, I think, is really interesting. A chronic inability to coexist with its near abroad. They can't just coexist now with nations next to them. They want to take over. They want to control. And this is something... Well, this desire for control, it's something that other politicians have picked up. Anne Widdecombe, she was a former Conservative politician. She stood for the Brexit Party. Over the last week, she gave a powerful speech in the European Parliament, a couple of minutes long, that, it's a nice standing up for Britain in Brussels, so I thought I'd share it with you. But she basically makes the same point, you know, that the EU has this instincts of an empire. It's undemocratic. Here's that soundbite from her.
May I say that I, if I needed any convincing at all, that the best thing for Britain is to leave here as soon as possible. It was the way that those elections were conducted yesterday. Because if that is this place's idea of democracy, then that is a serious betrayal of every country that is represented here. Yeah. Because it is not democratic at all. And that is just one of many reasons why Britain is right to be leaving this place, hopefully, on Halloween. And it is right because there is a pattern consistent throughout history of oppressed people turning on the oppressors, slaves against their owners, the peasantry against the feudal barons, colonies, Mr. Verhofstadt, against their empires. And that is why Britain is leaving. And it doesn't matter which language you use, we are going and we are glad to be going. I represent the southwest of the United Kingdom.
Piano, facciamo concludere.
And I found on my very first day that this place has decided, at least this place hasn't, the powers that be have decided to actually increase the size of fishermen's meshes, thereby reducing their income by 40%. That's what you do here. That's why we're going.
Grazie, concluda.
Wir gehen, we're off.
An entertaining clip from Anne Widdecombe criticizing the EU as an empire. She sees and understands Europe. Now, she got a whole lot of flack for that. A lot of people criticized her because she mentioned slavery. I mean, it's hard to disagree with what she said or even see a rational argument for being it beyond the pale by any extent, but that's the radical left for you. But she sees the nature of the European Union. Mr. Gerald Flory has talked about this. In fact, this was a quote from Britain Leaves, Keir David, he made right around, I think, when Britain voted to leave the European Union, where, you know, he basically forecasts to expect this, to expect Europe to become more dictatorial. You know, this, we're going to see its nature exposed more and more as Britain leaves. Here's that clip.
If you go back to the, let's say, the beginning of the European Union, and when they had the Maastricht Treaty and that, the Germans even then were demanding and did demand that they would not ratify that treaty unless the central bank were to be in Germany. Now they've been making demands ever since and getting most of them fulfilled. This is a nation that started both world wars, and in the beginning people were saying, well, yeah, what we have to do is get all these nations together and make sure that we anchor Germany to the European Union. But Margaret Thatcher said, why, it's just the reverse of that. She said, you've anchored the European Union to a newly dominant Germany. And dominant they have been, and they're going to be a lot more dominant from now on, and you can quickly see that. Now that Britain's out, that makes their path a lot easier, and you're going to see 10 nations come out of that European Union very quickly. Germany is absolutely dominating the European Union economically, financially, and politically.
So he said that you're going to see them be a lot more dominant from now on. You're going to see them try and push for control. And this is something Mr. Flory focused on in the July Trumpet print edition, the cover article there, Germany is taking control of the internet. And in that article, it's just like this story. You know, it's maybe this is one specific area where they're pushing for control, which is important by itself, but then the bigger picture of just this empire wanting to control, wanting to dominate, is really important. It's the spirit behind it. He wrote in that article, Germany's ambitions for the internet should concern everyone, even those who don't have a computer. The EU's behavior on this issue exposes the dictatorial nature of this German-dominated entity. And it's the same with this story. Going on, Mr. Flory wrote, really, we are witnessing the manifestation of the spirit of the Holy Roman Empire in the tech world. The biblically prophesied seventh and final resurrection of that empire wants to control the internet. He also wrote in that article, the EU is about Germany ruling more than just, or Germans ruling more than just Germany. They want an empire. They want to control the internet. And that is only a stepping stone to controlling the world. Every time it has risen, the Holy Roman Empire has made an attempt to do just that. These internet regulations show the spirit of Charlemagne has returned. It's the spirit of this empire, the spirit on display. Ambrose Evans Pritchard concludes his article, writing, some wit might acidly point to Article 7 of the Lisbon Treaty. The Union shall develop a special relationship with neighboring countries aimed at establishing, aimed to establish an area of prosperity and good neighborliness founded on the values of the Union and characterized by close and peaceful relations based on cooperation. Now, that's what the EU says that it's all about, neighborliness, close cooperation. But then you look at how they're acting in practice and what they're doing to Switzerland, and exposes that we're not dealing with a power that's all about neighborliness and cooperation between a brotherhood of nations. It's one that wants to control and dominate. And more, that is on display. And this is a critical part of what the Bible says that this European power is going to be like. Now, we can take a look at the book of Daniel. In Daniel chapter 7, it talks about this European power. God gives an overview here of thousands of years of European history. And this passage, well, included in this passage, there are prophecies about historical figures like Alexander the Great, prophecies that are so accurate that critics insist that, well, the book of Daniel must have been written after Alexander the Great, because no man could have written so accurately about Alexander the Great before he came on the scene. And, of course, no man could, but a book inspired by God certainly can do that. So it talks about Alexander the Great, but it also describes a lot of events following Alexander the Great. Daniel chapter 7 and verse 7, for example, describes a symbolic beast that is terrifying, dreadful. I'll just use the New Living Translation, not usually a great translation, but just to kind of put it in some up-to-date language. Terrifying, dreadful, and very strong. It said it devoured and crushed its victims with huge iron teeth and trampled their remains beneath its feet. Verse 23, again in the same translation, says that this beast will devour the whole world, trampling and crushing everything in its path. Describing these powers, Mr. Flory wrote, these are dreadful beasts that conquer and enslave entire nations. It's what these beasts do. He wrote, however, that Britain and America, quote, like to think of them as harmless wild animals. They fear to face the unpleasant truth. We don't like to think of them as having this kind of nature. Now, this beast that is describing in Daniel chapter 7, it's describing the Roman Empire, the empire that dominated the world after Alexander. But then the Bible describes this beast as having 10 horns, and you can see in verse 24 of this chapter that they are 10 kings or kingdoms that arise out of this beast. So for a time, this beast ruled the world, and then afterwards there would be 10 more resurrections of this beast. It would be back 10 more times, and we see people in history constantly trying to resurrect the Roman Empire, to bring it back. And that's the trend that you start to see in Switzerland. Now, it's a relatively mild start right now. It's just using economics. It's not nowhere near the full power and the full kind of desire to dominance that we see described in Daniel chapter 7. But Daniel 7 describes the power of the spirit of this beast. It explains its behavior, why it's all of a sudden no longer content just to kind of get on and cooperate with its neighbors, but wants to dominate. I mentioned that article by Mr. Flory on Germany's getting control of the internet. He had a Key of David on that subject as well, where he made some similar points about this power. So we can just play a couple of clips from that as well before we move on to talk about Switzerland specifically. Here's one clip from that Key of David.
Germany already domineers Europe, and everybody can see that, and they're being very dictatorial in the way they're directing the European Union. That is why Britain voted its way out, is because it was becoming so dictatorial, trying to really control every phase of a person's life. And now, look what they're doing.
That was, again, in context of this internet regulation, and you can see that same spirit on display with Switzerland. And we've just got one final short clip from that same Key of David on this subject.
Germany wants more than just to rule a nation, their own nation. They want an empire. That's what this is all about. They want to control the internet. And do you suppose they want to control the world? Well, the Holy Roman Empire has made an attempt to do just that every time it's risen.
Yeah, that's part of its nature, the Holy Roman Empire. Every time it's risen, it's tried to control the world. And now we're seeing Europe no longer just happy to cooperate with its neighbors. It wants to control them as well. Now, it's because of these kind of ambitions that back in December 2001, and this is from the Trumpet Print Edition, Mr. Gareth Fraser had an article. It was titled, Why Switzerland Will Not Remain Neutral. And it pretty much forecast exactly the situation that we see building now in Europe. In that book, in that article, he writes, it may come as a surprise to the reader to learn that the Swiss are the primary descendants of the Israelite tribe of Gad. And he quotes from The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Mr. Armstrong, a book that you can order your own free copy of at our website, thetrumpet.com. If you've not read it, it really is critical to understanding modern world events. But in that book, Mr. Armstrong writes, while the birthright was Joseph's, one of the 12 sons of Jacob, while the birthright was Joseph and its blessings have come to the British Commonwealth of Nations and the United States of America, yet the other 8 tribes of Israel were also God's chosen people. They too have been blessed with a good measure of material prosperity, but not the dominance of the birthright. And then a bit further down, he writes, 8 tribes have descended into such northwestern European nations as Holland, Belgium, Denmark, northern France, Luxembourg, Switzerland, Sweden, Norway. So this is one of those tribes. Well, this is one of those descendants of Israel, and they have had a good measure of prosperity. Not the same dominance, say, as Britain and America, the birthright powers, but they have had a good, they've been blessed with a good measure of prosperity. Genesis chapter 49 and 19 talks about Gad, the father of modern Switzerland. And it says there, Gad, a troop shall overcome him, but he shall overcome at the last. And the Jameson Fawcett Brown commentary about it states about Gad, this tribe shall be often attacked and wasted by hostile powers on their borders. And Mr. Fraser in this article writes, for centuries, hostile powers did overrun Swiss borders. Swiss history is replete with outside forces dominating its soil. And then he writes, Bible prophecy reveals the very intention of Gad's neutrality has been to prevent future ravagings at the hand of dynasties, empires, and dictators. But though the Swiss can run, they can't hide. The illusion of neutrality will not preserve them from the aspirations of Europe's Holy Roman Trojan horse, the increasingly federalist European Union. So he said, well, they've got this illusion of neutrality. In reality, they've still signed all of these deals with Europe, kind of earlier in the article. But that's not going to protect them from the Holy Roman Empire, this federalist European Union. For the Swiss, he writes, it's already too late. They just don't realize it yet. He writes a bit further down, if the Swiss think they can play neutrality games with the EU, they are gravely mistaken. And that's exactly what we're seeing now. The EU's masterful step-by-step strategy of extracting economic, political, and military cooperation from its subjects has worked on Switzerland. He writes, they escaped 2 world wars, but they shall not escape the third. Strategically placed Switzerland will soon feel the beast power bearing down upon their northern border and the false prophet mounting up to rise from the south. In the coming final European conflict, prophecy indicates sadly that the Swiss will suffer far more than just the breath of Nazism at its border. As a tribe of Israel, which has received precious blessings of God, Switzerland will be given the opportunity to turn back to him. Ahead of acquiring wealth and material prosperity, the Swiss must seek the true riches and wealth that can only come from unbending obedience to God's inexorable law. So he warned that they wouldn't escape, that they wouldn't be allowed to just remain neutral, that they would be dominated by the EU. And this is exactly what we see happening. Now, if you want to learn more about the nature of the European Union and God's purpose for allowing this empire to rise up repeatedly in Europe, you can get our free book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. Again, that's available on our website, thetrumpet.com. And that will, you know, that explains, that goes through all of this history, that really proves how the Bible prophesied of this nation, goes through some of those scriptures that we've talked about today. But more importantly, it also shows you God's plan behind this. There's a great hopeful message here too about God being in control of world events, God ruling in the kingdom of men, as it says in the book of Daniel. God having a plan for Switzerland, for Britain, for the United States, a plan to have these nations turn to him and receive just fantastic, wonderful blessings. So you can get that from our book, from our website, that book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, if you haven't read it already, at thetrumpet.com. We'll take a quick break, and then when we get back, we'll have a bit of a history segment with a lesson very applicable in your own life as well.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. The Holy Roman Empire has made pivotal and defining contributions to Western civilization. But its many reincarnations have also come with painful and catastrophic consequences. European leaders aim to unite the fractured continent of Europe by reviving the legacy of this extraordinary church-state combine. One of the great lessons of this empire is that it always comes back. There is always another resurrection. To understand much more on this vital subject, call now and request our free book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. The Holy Roman Empire is not just a relic of history. It is about to play a central role in world events. Coming to understand about the nature and character of this powerful institution tells you as much about the future as it does about the past. As part of this free offer, also request Herbert Armstrong's classic work, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast? Both booklets are available at no cost or obligation to you. In addition to the free book, you may also request a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. The Trumpet examines world events under the clear light of Bible prophecy. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
There is going to be a resurrection of that old Roman Empire. Not very many people believe it, because people have gotten completely beyond really believing that the Bible means what it says. You're going to have to live and see it, and you're going to have to know that God was speaking when he said this thing is coming.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Hello, and welcome back to The Trumpet Daily radio show. We've been covering, some news this morning. We're talking a bit about the EU's pressure on Switzerland. But I want to get into a bit of history now, a fascinating example from a great warrior. And one lesson that we can learn from him. I mean, if you've been following along with this program recently, in recent months, you'll know that that your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry, he has a book club going where, at least back when the school was in session, they were all reading the same book, and he had some videos up of some of their discussions on the book, on our website, thetrumpet.com, and on his section on the website, you could go and see those videos. And they'd been going through Andrew Roberts' book, Napoleon the Great. Now, I'd already read that book a year or so back, so I decided to do a bit of reading along about a man, a contemporary of Napoleon, the man who ultimately beat Napoleon, the Duke of Wellington. And actually, a while ago, even before then, when I first picked up a book on Wellington, Mr. Flurry encouraged me to share some of that with you on this show when I'd finished. So I thought I'd do some of that today. Now, one of the big things people know about the Duke of Wellington is the Battle of Waterloo. Well, that, and I guess Wellington boots is the other common usage thing people kind of associate with him. You know, they know he won the Battle of Waterloo. There's the ABBA song, etc. But what is less commonly known is, but a really outstanding part of his life is the Peninsular War. You know, his campaigns against Napoleon in Spain and Portugal. I mean, Waterloo was one battle. For the Peninsular War, he was overseeing this pretty major operation in Spain for several years. And I want to take one lesson from just a pivotal part of that Peninsular War. But to get there, I have to cover just a little bit of history. So Portugal has the distinction of being Britain's oldest ally in Europe, maybe even one of the oldest in the world. And during the Napoleonic Wars, Portugal refused to abandon its ally. So in 1807, Napoleon was winning in Europe. He'd conquered all of these different places. He'd signed the Treaty of Tilsit with Russia. So they were at peace. And so he pretty much he dominated all of Europe. He didn't dominate Britain. And so he was trying to bring Britain to heel, to control Britain through a siege, through a blockade, starving their economy. Some parallels, I guess, even a little with Switzerland and what we talked about in the first half. And so he wanted to force all the countries of Europe to blockade Britain, and that included Portugal. Now, he told Portugal, he sent them an ultimatum, basically, you have to declare war on Britain or else. Portugal refused to declare war on Britain, and so he invaded Portugal via Spain in 1807. And it was a pretty easy affair. Portugal wasn't able to put up really much resistance to the French Empire. They did, the big piece of resistance that they did do is that the king, a lot of the leaders, took the Portuguese fleet and fled for Brazil with that and with whatever they could carry. And that was a great act of defiance, and it made sure that Napoleon didn't get a hold of their fleet. But really, it's no shade on them. There just wasn't much that they could do at this point in time and in their history to stand up to the French Empire. So France came in. And then in 1808, Napoleon put his brother Joseph on the throne of Spain. And so then Spain revolted against him, and there were all of these uprisings in Spain. Then in the summer of 1808, the British landed in Portugal with a force under Wellington, though he wasn't called Wellington yet. That was just plain old Arthur Wellesley. And again, even that gets confusing because at one point he changed his name from Wesley to Wellesley. But anyway, we'll just keep calling him Wellington throughout this, even though he wasn't the Duke of Wellington until towards the end of this campaign. So he landed in Portugal, and throughout the whole of the Peninsular Wars, Wellington faced the same basic problem of he was outnumbered. The French had far more troops in the Iberian Peninsula than he did. However, the French also had to have them spread out to deal with all the Spanish resistance and these different uprisings and things like that. And one of Wellington's main ways of dealing with this, was to try and move fast, to be really aggressive, to go on the offensive quickly, and to attack the French armies while they were separate before they could combine against him. He was able to do that at this phase in the war, though for a long part of the war that wasn't an option, but that was one of his key ways of trying to deal with this. And so Marshal Junot was in Portugal at the time. He won some great victories over Junot after landing. But as soon as the main battle that he fought there was over, defeating Junot, a more senior officer, British officer, arrived on the scene and superseded him. Now, Wellington was eager to press the advantage. He'd just won a battle. He'd had a great victory. And so he wanted to go and basically just reap the fruit of that victory, to go and pursue the disorganized French. And to do as much as possible to liberate Portugal. But that senior officer was much more cautious, much less offensively minded, and he prevented him. And then soon even more senior generals arrived. And again, they lacked the same offensive mentality and eagerness to fight. And they were more kind of scared and less confident, more afraid of the French. And they ended up signing an ignominious truce with the French. Wellington got a lot of the blame for signing this pretty terrible truce in the era, even though he had not been in charge of negotiating it, and the fact that he had wanted to go on the offensive. You know, public opinion is definitely not always fair. And so he was recalled home to go and kind of face the criticism for this truce. Now, while he was away, Napoleon himself invaded Spain to deal with these uprisings and the British presence there with 300,000 men. He defeated the Spanish. He inflicted a major defeat on the British, even killing the British commander, John Moore. Meanwhile, Ned Wellington was back at home. He managed to clear his name, at least in terms of, you know, kind of officially, as far as the army was concerned. And in the public side to a certain degree, though, there was still some criticism of him. But he was back the next year, and this time in 1809, and this time in full command. And he won some significant victories like Talavera. But that brings us now, that recap of history, to the time period I want to focus on. And I think one of the most remarkable parts of the whole campaign, of the whole Peninsular War. Though there are several remarkable parts. Wellington's victory had brought the French to one conclusion, that Wellington must be pushed back into the sea, that they had to gather up a big force and just get rid of him once and for all. So they gathered together a huge army. There was one person referred to it as a whole host of marshals. I think it was around 120,000, 80,000 of which would go into Portugal, which really outnumbered Wellington very significantly at that time. The host of marshals, it included Mortier, Ney, Soult, Victor, and Kellermann, all lined up against him with, I've forgotten the name, I have it written down somewhere, who was in overall command. I'll find that when I get to it, I guess. But anyway, they were coming down to, Mura. I think, was it Mura? I'll find it as we go. Messina, there we go. Messina was in command. And literally everybody thought it was a foregone conclusion that the British would lose. George Murray, one of Wellington's right-hand men, he was writing back to England, and he said, "There are some people who seem to fancy we can defend Portugal, but upon what solid grounds their expectations are founded, I do not know." Roland Hill, another officer with him, he wrote, "The Spanish and Portuguese cause, in my mind, is hopeless. They will do nothing for themselves, and we can do no more than we have done." You know, back in England, just about every military expert said that that's it. It's over. Britain is now about to be defeated. There's nothing that they can do. Even the government was convinced that Britain was about to lose. The Earl of Liverpool, he was the Secretary for War. He wrote to Wellington and said, "A very considerable degree of alarm exists respecting the safety of the British army in Portugal." And he said that he would rather be excused for bringing away the army a little too soon than, by remaining in Portugal a little too long, expose it to those risks from which no military operation can be wholly exempt. Someone else wrote that all the officers coming back from Portugal entertained and avowed the most desponding views as to the results of the war. So even the government thought, well, no, we're going to lose. We should probably bring the army back. Now, at this point, the government, though, had a great deal of respect for Wellington. And he was just about the only man in the whole world who thought the British could win. And so, thankfully, the government deferred to his judgment. But to me, this is one of the most remarkable instances of the whole campaign. The stakes were huge. If Wellington had lost, he himself quipped that this was Britain's only army and he couldn't afford to lose it. I mean, you imagine trying to evacuate the army from Portugal. It could have been disastrous. You could have had tens of thousands captured or killed. Worse, the political situation back home was shaky. If there was an ignominious defeat, the government would have certainly have fallen. The opposition wanted peace with France. So if he'd have failed to defend Portugal now after committing to it, Britain could have been knocked out of the war with France. Napoleon would have been immeasurably more secure on his throne. In his book, Wellington, The Path to Victory, Rory Muir, he wrote, the full weight of responsibility for maintaining the British army in the peninsula thus fell on Wellington's shoulders. For although the government took the final decision, it rested entirely on his advice. He said that Wellington was mortified at the strength and unanimity of opinion in Britain, which regarded the defence of Portugal as hopeless. But he was confident. Benjamin Durbin, he wrote, the firmness of mind with which Lord Wellington has continued to preserve since the Battle of Talavera, in spite of the despondency of almost everyone about him, as well as the people at home, and the perseverance with which he has continued in forward position, ready for offensive operations, yet fully prepared for defensive ones, has saved Portugal and may and probably will be the salvation of Spain. This admirable firmness proves him a hero, if he had done nothing else to deserve that name. So the result was he stood firm while everybody else thought that he would fail. And it basically took an astonishing level of confidence to go ahead and do that. Again, facing this very skilled army of Napoleon's army under Massena. You know, confidence alone isn't the only key to success. There are a lot of generals that are very confident and now very dead. You've got to have something to back that confidence up. And he basically based his confidence on two things. One was the Portuguese army. The Portuguese army was pretty much brand new. We mentioned Napoleon had just walked in there earlier. But since Britain had got involved, quite a few British officers under William Beresford had been training and building up a new Portuguese army along British lines. And so Wellington had confidence that the Portuguese army would perform well. A lot of others doubted that. And the second basis for his confidence was the lines of Torres Vedras. This was a series of walls and fortifications built along the main French invasion route. The French had no idea of the construction of these lines. It was built under the engineer Sir Richard Fletcher. And there were very strong lines of fortification built in a pretty short period of time. And the end result was that these lines were so strong the French couldn't pass through them. Massena had never even tried. He camped outside these lines for a month, trying to tempt Wellington into attacking him. And then Massena had to retreat. His army had to get back somewhere where it could feed itself over the winter. You know, they had to retreat, and now the Allies could go on the offensive and chase them. So the result was even though there wasn't a big battle at the lines of Torres Vedras, the result was Britain held. Wellington was not kicked out of Portugal the way the whole rest of the world thought that they would. Alexander Gordon, another key subordinate of Wellington, he wrote that we have certainly made the most glorious campaign Great Britain ever made since the days of Marlborough, and France one of the most disgraceful. Massena's army lost around some 25,000 men dead or captured. So that was those permanently lost to the army. And Muir wrote, it was the greatest, most obvious and undeniable defeat suffered by French arms since the establishment of the empire 7 years earlier. Now, it showed that the French could be beaten. And he wrote, the credit for the Allied success, even more than with most military operations, belongs principally to Wellington. Without him, the British army would almost certainly have been withdrawn from Portugal after offering only token resistance to the French advance. It was his foresight and inspiration that devised the plan that made the defense of Portugal possible, and his strength of character, self-confidence, and determination that carried it through in the face of widespread doubt and skepticism. And that's the lesson that I want to take from this, that we can apply to our own personal battles to overcome. This confidence and determination, strength of character, to carry something through against doubt and skepticism. Now, it can't be, again, an empty confidence. There must be something behind it. And this is where I think the parallels are even stronger for us. In Philippians chapter 4 and verse 13, you know, Christ talked about, well, I can do everything through Christ that strengthens me. You know, he had 100% confidence. He never thought, well, maybe I might be beaten. Maybe I should retreat here. Maybe I shouldn't go into this town. This trial is pretty hard. I'm not sure I can do this. He had 100% confidence, but based in Christ. Wellington's was in large part a self-confidence, but Paul had an even firmer confidence in God. And that's a confidence we can and must have. Mr. Gerald Flurry, he He wrote in his book, John's Gospel, he wrote that even though Christ went through all the troubles, you won't find even a hint of him thinking about failure in the whole Bible. I don't believe Christ for one moment ever considered failing, and neither should you. Never consider failing. We have access to all the power a person can need. We can have total confidence in victory. Now, this isn't a case of just pulling yourselves up by your own bootstraps or just looking in the mirror and kind of saying, I have confidence, I can do it. Really, when we're talking about confidence in victory, confidence in God, we're talking about faith, having faith, growing in faith, which is a spiritual issue. It is something that comes through prayer and through study. It's not a case of psyching ourselves up or just trying to build this belief through some kind of pulling ourselves up. It's something that can only come through contact with God. But we can and must have this kind of high morale in our battles. That's something Mr. Flurry draws attention to in his book, The Science of Spiritual Warfare. So we can go through in total confidence. And that confidence, like I said, comes ultimately from contact with God. Mr. Flurry wrote in that book on the science of spiritual warfare on this subject of high morale, a belief that we can do it and confidence in victory, that this is an issue that will be decided in your prayer closet. This is where you will get most of your power. Are you close enough to Christ? Do you use your prayer closet enough and powerfully enough that you truly have high morale? Well, that is about all we've got time for. We've got an exciting lineup of guest speakers, of on-the-road material from Mr. Flurry as he travels and participates in PYC coming up over the next few days. Please do keep tuning in here at TD at KPCG on YouTube or on over the air on 101.3 on the FM dial.